I'm not sure I can take it even now. Neither your kind of renunciation nor my own. But Francisco, she threw her head back suddenly to look up at him. If this was your secret, then of all the hell you had to take, I was...
Oh, yes, my darling, yes. You were the worst of it. It was a desperate cry. It sounded of laughter and of release, confessing all the agony he wanted to sweep away. He seized her hand. He pressed his mouth to it, then his face, not to let her see the reflection of what his years had been like. If it's any kind of atonement, which it isn't. Whatever I made you suffer, that's how I paid for it, by knowing what I was doing to you, and having to do it, and waiting, waiting to... But it's over. He raised his head, smiling. He looked down at her, and she saw a look of protective tenderness come into his face, which told her of the despair he saw in hers. Dagny, don't think of that. I won't claim any suffering of mine as my excuse. Whatever my reason, I knew what I was doing, and I've hurt you terribly. I'll need years to make up for it. Forget what? She knew that he meant what his embrace had confessed. What I haven't said. Of all the things I have to tell you, that is the one I'll say last. But his eyes, his smile, the grasp of his fingers on her wrist were saying it against his will. You've borne too much, and there's a great deal that you have to learn to understand in order to lose every scar of the torture you never should have had to bear. All that matters now is that you're free to recover. We're free, both of us, we're free of the looters. We're out of their reach. She said, her voice quietly desolate. That's what I came here for, to try to understand. But I can't. It seems monstrously wrong to surrender the world to the looters, and monstrously wrong to live under their rule. I can neither give up nor go back. I can neither exist without work nor work as a serf. I'd always thought that any sort of battle was proper, anything, except renunciation. I'm not sure we're right to quit, you and I, when we should have fought them. But there is no way to fight. It's surrender if we leave, and surrender if we remain. I don't know what is right any longer. Check your premises, Dagny. Contradictions don't exist. But I can't find any answer. I can't condemn you for what you're doing, yet it's horror that I feel. Admiration and horror at the same time. You, the heir of the Donconias, who could have surpassed all his ancestors of the miraculous hand that produced. You're turning your matchless ability to the job of destruction. And I'm playing with cobblestones and shingling a roof while a transcontinental railroad system is collapsing in the hands of congenital ward healers. Yet you and I were the kind to determine the fate of the world. If this is what we let it come to, then it must have been our own guilt. But I can't see the nature of our error. Yes, Dagny, it was our own guilt. Because we didn't work hard enough? Because we worked too hard, and charged too little. What do you mean? We never demanded the one payment that the world owed us, and we let our best reward go to the worst of men. The error was made centuries ago. It was made by Sebastian Donconia, by Nat Taggart, by every man who fed the world and received no thanks in return. You don't know what is right any longer? Dagny, this is not a battle over material goods. It's a moral crisis, the greatest the world has ever faced, and the last. Our age is the climax of centuries of evil. We must put an end to it once and for all, or perish. We, the men of the mind. It was our own guilt. We produced the wealth of the world, but we let our enemies write its moral code. But we never accepted their code. We lived by our own standards. Yes, and paid ransoms for it. Ransoms in matter and in spirit, in money which our enemies received but did not deserve, and in honor which we deserved but did not receive. That was our guilt, that we were willing to pay. We kept mankind alive, yet we allowed men to despise us and to worship our destroyers. We allowed them to worship incompetence and brutality, the recipients and the dispensers of the unearned. By accepting punishment, not for our sins, but for our virtues, we betrayed our code and made theirs possible. Dagny, theirs is the morality of kidnappers. They use your love of virtue as a hostage. They know that you'll bear anything in order to work and produce, because you know that achievement is man's highest moral purpose, that he can't exist without it.
and your love of virtue is your love of life. They count on you to assume any burden. They count on you to feel that no effort is too great in the service of your love. Dagny, your enemies are destroying you by means of your own power. Your generosity and your endurance are their only tools. Your unrequited rectitude is the only hold they have upon you. They know it. You don't. The day when you'll discover it is the only thing they dread. You must learn to understand them. You won't be free of them until you do. But when you do, you'll reach such a stage of rightful anger that you'll blast every rail of Taggart Transcontinental rather than let it serve them.
But to leave it to them, she moaned. To abandon it. To abandon Taggart Transcontinental. When it's almost like a living person.
It was. It isn't any longer. Leave it to them. It won't do them any good. Let it go. We don't need it. We can rebuild it. They can't. We'll survive without it. They won't.
But we, brought down to renouncing and giving up.
Dagny, we who've been called materialists by the killers of the human spirit, we're the only ones who know how little value or meaning there is in material objects as such, because we're the ones who create their value and meaning. We can afford to give them up for a short while in order to redeem something much more precious. We are the soul, of which railroads, copper mines, steel mills, and oil wells are the body, and they are living entities that beat day and night like our hearts in the sacred function of supporting human life. But only so long as they remain our body, only so long as they remain the expression, the reward, and the property of achievement. Without us they are corpses, and their sole product is poison, not wealth or food. The poison of disintegration that turns men to hordes of scavengers.
Dagny, learn to understand the nature of your own power, and you'll understand the paradox that you now see around you. You do not have to depend on any material possessions. They depend on you. You create them. You own the one and only tool of production. Wherever you are, you will always be able to produce. But the looters, by their own stated theory, are in desperate permanent congenital need, and at the blind mercy of matter. Why don't you take them at their word? They need railroads, factories, mines, motors, which they cannot make or run. Of what use will your railroad be to them without you? Who held it together? Who kept it alive? Who saved it time and time again? Was it your brother James? Who fed him? Who fed the looters? Who produced their weapons? Who gave them the means to enslave you? The impossible spectacle of shabby little incompetence holding control over the products of genius? Who made it possible? Who supported your enemies? Who forged your chains? Who destroyed your achievement?
The motion that threw her upright was like a silent cry. He shot to his feet with the stored abruptness of a spring uncoiling, his voice driving on in merciless triumph. You're beginning to see, aren't you, Dagny? Leave them the carcass of that railroad. Leave them all the rusted rails and rotted ties and gutted engines, but don't leave them your mind. Don't leave them your mind. The fate of the world rests on that decision.
Ladies and gentlemen, said the panic-pregnant voice of a radio announcer, breaking off the chords of the symphony, we interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin. The greatest disaster in railroad history occurred in the early hours of the morning on the main line of Taggart Transcontinental at Winston, Colorado, demolishing the famous Taggart Tunnel.
Her scream sounded like the screams that had rung out in the one last moment in the darkness of the tunnel. Its sound remained with him through the rest of the broadcast, as they both ran to the radio in the cabin and stood in equal terror, her eyes staring at the radio, his eyes watching her face. The details of the story were obtained from Luke Beale, fireman of the Taggart luxury mainliner, the Comet, who was found unconscious at the western portal of the tunnel this morning, and who appears to be the sole survivor of the catastrophe. Through some astounding infraction of safety rules, in circumstances not yet fully established, the Comet westbound for San Francisco was sent into the tunnel with a coal-burning steam locomotive. The Taggart Tunnel, an 8-mile bore, cut through the summit of the Rocky Mountains and regarded as an engineering achievement not to be equaled in our time, was built by the grandson of Nathaniel Taggart in the great age of the clean, smokeless diesel-electric engine. The tunnel's ventilation system was not designed to provide for the heavy smoke and fumes of coal-burning locomotives, and it was known to every railroad employee in the district that to send a train into the tunnel with such a locomotive would mean death by suffocation for everyone aboard. The Comet, nonetheless, was so ordered to proceed.
According to Fireman Beale, the effects of the fumes began to be felt when the train was about 3 miles inside the tunnel. Engineer Joseph Scott threw the throttle wide open in a desperate attempt to gain speed, but the old worn engine was inadequate for the weight of the long train and the rising grade of the track. Struggling through the thickening fumes, engineer and fireman had barely managed to force the leaking steam boilers up to a speed of 40 miles per hour, when some passenger, prompted undoubtedly by the panic of choking, pulled the emergency brake cord. The sudden jolt of the stop apparently broke the engine's air hose, for the train could not be started again. There were screams coming from the cars, passengers were breaking windows. Engineer Scott struggled frantically to make the engine start, but collapsed at the throttle, overcome by the fumes. Fireman Beale leaped from the engine and ran. He was within sight of the western portal when he heard the blast of the explosion, which is the last thing he remembers. The rest of the story was gathered from railroad employees at Winston Station. It appears that an Army freight special westbound carrying a heavy load of explosives had been given no warning about the presence of the comet on the track just ahead. Both trains had encountered delays and were running off their schedules. It appears that the freight special had been ordered to proceed regardless of signals because the tunnel's signal system was out of order. It is said that in spite of speed regulations and in view of the frequent breakdowns of the ventilating system, it was the tacit custom of all engineers to go full speed while in the tunnel. It appears, as far as can be established at present, that the comet was stalled just beyond the point where the tunnel makes a sharp curve. It is believed that everyone aboard was dead by that time. It is doubted that the engineer of the freight special taking a curve at 80 miles an hour would have been able to see in time the observation window of the comet's last car, which was brightly lighted when it left Winston Station. What is known is that the freight special crashed into the rear of the comet. The explosion of the special's cargo broke windows in a farmhouse 5 miles away and brought down such a weight of rock upon the tunnel that rescue parties have not yet been able to come within 3 miles of where either train had been. It is not expected that any survivors will be found. And it is not believed that the Taggart Tunnel can ever be rebuilt. The sudden explosion of Taggart's voice sounded as if he had been slapped.
Who are you to stand against the government? Who are you? You miserable little office rat, to judge national policies and hold opinions of your own. Do you think the country has time to bother about your opinions, your wishes, or your precious little conscience? You're going to learn a lesson, all of you spoiled, self-indulgent, undisciplined little two-bit clerks who strut as if that crap about your rights was serious. You're going to learn that these are not the days of Nat Taggart.
Eddie said nothing. For an instant, they stood looking at each other across the desk. Taggart's face was distorted by terror. Eddie's remained sternly serene. James Taggart believed the existence of an Eddie Willers too well. Eddie Willers could not believe the existence of a James Taggart.
"Do you think the nation will bother about your wishes or hers?" screamed Taggart. "It's her duty to come back. It's her duty to work. What do we care whether she wants to work or not? We need her."
"Do you, Jim?" An impulse pertaining to self-preservation made Taggart back a step away from the sound of that particular tone, a very quiet tone, in the voice of Eddie Willers. But Eddie made no move to follow. He remained standing behind his desk in a manner suggesting the civilized tradition of a business office. "You won't find her," he said. "She won't be back. I'm glad she won't. You can starve, you can close the railroad, you can throw me in jail, you can have me shot. What does it matter? I won't tell you where she is. If I see the whole country crashing, I won't tell you. You won't find her. You—" They whirled at the sound of the entrance door flung open. They saw Dagny standing on the threshold. She wore a wrinkled cotton dress, and her hair was disheveled by hours of driving. She stopped for the duration of a glance around her, as if to recapture the place, but there was no recognition of persons in her eyes. The glance merely swept through the room, as if making a swift inventory of physical objects. Her face was not the face they remembered. It had aged, not by means of lines, but by means of a still, naked look, stripped of any quality save ruthlessness. Yet their first response, ahead of shock or wonder, was a single emotion that went through the room like a gasp of relief. It was in all their faces, but one. Eddie Willers, who alone had been calm a moment ago, collapsed with his face down on his desk. He made no sound, but the movements of his shoulders were sobs. Her face gave no sign of acknowledgement to anyone, no greeting, as if her presence here were inevitable and no words were necessary. She went straight to the door of her office, passing the desk of her secretary,
she said, her voice like the sound of a business machine, neither rude nor gentle. Ask Eddie to come in. James Taggart was the first one to move, as if dreading to let her out of his sight. He rushed in after her. He cried, "I couldn't help it!" And then, life returning to him, his own, his normal kind of life, he screamed, "It was your fault. You did it. You're to blame for it, because you left." He wondered whether his scream had been an illusion inside his own ears. Her face remained blank, yet she had turned to him. She looked as if sounds had reached her, but not words, not the communication of a mind. What he felt for a moment was his closest approach to a sense of his own non-existence. Then he saw the faintest change in her face, merely the indication of perceiving a human presence. But she was looking past him, and he turned and saw that Eddie Willers had entered the office. There were traces of tears in Eddie's eyes, but he made no attempt to hide them. He stood straight, as if the tears, or any embarrassment, or any apology for them, were as irrelevant to him as to her. She said, "Get Ryan on the telephone. Tell him I'm here, then let me speak to him." Ryan had been the general manager of the Railroad Central region. Eddie gave her a warning by not answering at once, then said, his voice as even as hers, "Ryan's gone, Dagny. He quit last week." They did not notice Taggart, as they did not notice the furniture around them. She had not granted him even the recognition of ordering him out of her office. Like a paralytic, uncertain of his muscles' obedience, he gathered his strength and slipped out. But he was certain of the first thing he had to do. He hurried to his office to destroy his letter of resignation. She did not notice his exit. She was looking at Eddie. "Is Noland here?" she asked. "No, he's gone." "Andrews?" "Gone." "McGuire?" "Gone." He went on quietly to recite the list of those he knew she would ask for, those most needed in this hour who had resigned and vanished within the past month. She listened without astonishment or emotion, as one listens to the casualty list of a battle where all are doomed, and it makes no difference whose names fall first. When he finished, she made no comment, but asked, "What has been done since this morning?" "Nothing." "Nothing?" "Dagny, any office boy could have issued orders here since this morning, and everybody would have obeyed him. But even the office boys know that whoever makes the first move today will be held responsible for the future, the present, and the past. When the buck passing begins, he would not save the system. He would merely lose his job by the time he saved one division. Nothing has been done. It's stopped still. Whatever is moving on anyone's blind guess, out on the line where they don't know whether they're to move or to stop. Some trains are held at stations, others are going on, waiting to be stopped before they reach Colorado. It's whatever the local dispatchers decide. The terminal manager downstairs has canceled all transcontinental traffic for today, including tonight's Comet. I don't know what the manager in San Francisco is doing. Only the wrecking crews are working at the tunnel. They haven't come anywhere near the wreck as yet. I don't think they will. Phone the terminal manager downstairs and tell him to put all transcontinental trains back on the schedule at once, including tonight's Comet. Then come back here." When he came back, she was bending over the maps she had spread on a table, and she spoke while he made rapid notes. "Route all westbound trains south from Kirby, Nebraska, down the spur track to Hastings, down the track of the Kansas Western to Laurel, Kansas, then to the track of the Atlantic Southern at Jasper, Oklahoma, west on the Atlantic Southern to Flagstaff, Arizona, north on the track of the Flagstaff-Homedale to Elgin, Utah, north to Midland, northwest on the track of the Wasatch Railway to Salt Lake City. The Wasatch Railway is an abandoned narrow gauge. Buy it. Have the gauge spread to standard. If the owners are afraid, since sales are illegal, pay them twice the money and proceed with the work. There is no rail between Laurel, Kansas and Jasper, Oklahoma. 3 miles. No rail between Elgin and Midland, Utah. 5.5 miles. Have the rail laid. Have construction crews start at once. Recruit every local man available. Pay twice the legal wages, 3 times anything they ask. Put 3 shifts on and have the job done overnight. For rail, tear up the sidings at Winston, Colorado, at Silver Springs, Colorado, at Leeds, Utah, at Benson, Nevada. If any local stooges of the Unification Board come to stop the work, give authority to our local men, the ones you trust, to bribe them. Don't put that through the accounting department. Charge it to me. I'll pay it. If they find some case where it doesn't work, have them tell the stooge that Directive 10-289 does not provide for local injunctions, that an injunction has to be brought against our headquarters, and that they have to sue me if they wish to stop us. Is that true? How do I know? How can anybody know? But by the time they untangle it and decide whatever it is they please to decide, our track will be built. I see. I'll go over the lists and give you the names of our local men to put in charge, if they're still there. By the time tonight's comet reaches Kirby, Nebraska, the track will be ready. It will add about 36 hours to the transcontinental schedule. But there will be a transcontinental schedule. Then have them get for me, out of the files, the old maps of our road as it was before Nat Taggart's grandson built the tunnel. The... what? He did not raise his voice, but the catch of his breath was the break of emotion he had wanted to avoid. Her face did not change, but a faint note in her voice acknowledged him, a note of gentleness, not reproof. The old maps of the days before the tunnel. We're going back, Eddie. Let's hope we can. No, we won't rebuild the tunnel. There's no way to do it now. But the old grade that crossed the Rockies is still there. It can be reclaimed. Only it will be hard to get the rail for it, and the men to do it, particularly the men. He knew, as he had known from the first, that she had seen his tears, and that she had not walked past in indifference, even though her clear, toneless voice and unmoving face gave him no sign of feeling. There was some quality in her manner, which he sensed but could not translate. Yet the feeling it gave him, translated, was as if she were saying to him, "I know, I understand. I would feel compassion and gratitude if we were alive and free to feel. But we're not, are we, Eddie? We're on a dead planet like the moon where we must move, not dare to stop for a breath of feeling, or we'll discover that there is no air to breathe. We have today and tomorrow to get things started," she said. "I'll leave for Colorado tomorrow night. If you want to fly, I'll have to rent a plane for you somewhere. Yours is still in the shops. They can't get the parts for it." "No, I'll go by rail. I have to see the line. I'll take tomorrow's comet." It was 2 hours later, in a brief pause between long-distance phone calls, that she asked him suddenly the first question which did not pertain to the railroad. "What have they done to Hank Reardon?" Eddie caught himself in the small evasion of looking away, forced his glance back to meet hers, and answered, "He gave in. He signed their gift certificate at the last moment." "Oh." The sound conveyed no shock or censure. It was merely a vocal punctuation mark, denoting the acceptance of a fact. "Have you heard from Quentin Daniels?" "No." "He sent no letter or message for me?" "No." He guessed the thing she feared, and it reminded him of a matter he had not reported. "Dagny, there's another problem that's been growing all over the system since you left. Since May 1st. It's the frozen trains."
"The what?"
"We've had trains abandoned on the line, on some passing track in the middle of nowhere, usually at night, with the entire crew gone. They just leave the train and vanish. There's never any warning given or any special reason. It's more like an epidemic. It hits the men suddenly, and they go. It's been happening on other railroads, too. Nobody can explain it. But I think that everybody understands. It's the directive that's doing it. It's our men's form of protest. They try to go on, and then they suddenly reach a moment when they can't take it any longer. What can we do about it?" He shrugged. "Oh, well, who is John Galt?" She nodded thoughtfully. She did not look astonished. The telephone rang, and the voice of her secretary said, "Mr. Wesley Mooch calling from Washington, Miss Taggart." Her lips stiffened a little, as at the unexpected touch of an insect. "It must be for my brother," she said.
"No, Miss Taggart, for you."
"All right, put him on." "Miss Taggart," said the voice of Wesley Mooch, in the tone of a cocktail party host, "I was so glad to hear you've regained your health that I wanted to welcome you back in person. I know that your health required a long rest, and I appreciate the patriotism that made you cut your leave of absence short in this terrible emergency. I wanted to assure you that you can count on our cooperation in any step you now find it necessary to take, our fullest cooperation, assistance, and support. If there are any special exceptions you might require, please feel certain that they can be granted." She let him speak, even though he had made several small pauses inviting an answer. When his pause became long enough, she said, "I would be much obliged if you would let me speak to Mr. Weatherby."
"Why, of course, Miss Taggart, any time you wish."
"Why, that is,
do you mean now?"
"Yes, right now." He understood, but he said, "Yes, Miss Taggart." When Mr. Weatherby's voice came on the wire, it sounded cautious. "Yes, Miss Taggart.
Of what service can I be to you?
You can tell your boss that if he doesn't want me to quit again, as he knows I did, he is never to call me or speak to me. Anything your gang has to tell me, let them send you to tell it. I'll speak to you, but not to him. You may tell him that my reason is what he did to Hank Reardon when he was on Reardon's payroll. If everybody else has forgotten it, I haven't.
It is my duty to assist the nation's railroads at any time, Miss Taggart. Mr. Weatherby sounded as if he were trying to avoid the commitment of having heard what he had heard. But a sudden note of interest crept into his voice as he asked slowly, thoughtfully, with guarded shrewdness, "Am I to understand, Miss Taggart, that it is your wish to deal exclusively with me in all official matters? May I take this as your policy?" She gave a brief, harsh chuckle. "Go ahead," she said. "You may list me as your exclusive property. Use me as a special item of pull and trade me all over Washington. But I don't know what good that will do you, because I'm not going to play the game. I'm not going to trade favors. I'm simply going to start breaking your laws right now, and you can arrest me when you feel that you can afford to."
"I believe that you have an old-fashioned idea about law, Miss Taggart. Why speak of rigid, unbreakable laws? Our modern laws are elastic and open to interpretation according to circumstances."
"Then start being elastic right now, because I'm not, and neither are railroad catastrophes." She hung up and said to Eddie, in the tone of an estimate passed on physical objects, "They'll leave us alone for a while." She did not seem to notice the changes in her office, the absence of Nat Taggart's portrait, the new glass coffee table where Mr. Losey had spread for the benefit of visitors, a display of the loudest humanitarian magazines, with titles of articles headlined on their covers. She heard with the attentive look of a machine equipped to record, not to react, Eddie's account of what 1 month had done to the railroad. She heard his report on what he guessed about the causes of the catastrophe. She faced with the same look of detachment a succession of men who went in and out of her office with overhurried steps and hands fumbling in superfluous gestures. He thought that she had become impervious to anything. But suddenly, while pacing the office, dictating to him a list of track-laying materials and where to obtain them illegally, she stopped and looked down at the magazines on the coffee table. Their headlines said, "The New Social Conscience, Our Duty to the Underprivileged, Need Versus Greed." With a single movement of her arm, the abrupt, explosive movement of sheer physical brutality such as he had never seen from her before, she swept the magazines off the table and went on, her voice reciting a list of figures without a break, as if there were no connection between her mind and the violence of her body. Late in the afternoon, finding a moment alone in her office, she telephoned Hank Reardon. She gave her name to his secretary, and she heard in the way he said it the haste with which he had seized the receiver.
"Dagny?"
"Hello, Hank. I'm back."
"Where?"
"In my office." She heard the things he did not say in the moment's silence on the wire. Then he said,
"I suppose I'd better start bribing people at once to get the ore to start pouring rail for you."
"Yes, as much of it as you can. It doesn't have to be Reardon metal. It can be." The break in her voice was almost too brief to notice, but what it held was the thought, Reardon metal rail for going back to the time before heavy steel? Perhaps back to the time of wooden rails with strips of iron? "It can be steel, any weight, anything you can give me."
"All right. Dagny, do you know that I've surrendered Reardon metal to them? I've signed the gift certificate."
"Yes, I know."
"I've given in."
"Who am I to blame you? Haven't I?" He did not answer, and she said, "Hank, I don't think they care whether there's a train or a blast furnace left on Earth. We do. They're holding us by our love of it, and we'll go on paying so long as there's still one chance left to keep one single wheel alive and moving in token of human intelligence. We'll go on holding it afloat, like our drowning child. And when the flood swallows it, we'll go down with the last wheel and the last syllogism. I know what we're paying, but price is no object any longer."
"I know."
"Don't be afraid for me, Hank. I'll be all right by tomorrow morning."
"I'll never be afraid for you, darling. I'll see you tonight."